Thank you so much. So my talk is based off of the project I did last year with Dr. Balbus that was also my capstone for my MPH, and it is analyzing the health co-benefits of high penetration renewable energy deployment in the United States. Although I was associated with the NIH while doing this, and Dr. Balbus is with the NIH, this does not represent the opinions or conclusions of the NIH or the United States government, and we have no competing financial interests. So starting with a little bit of background, I've had sort of a nice lead up in this talk with a variety of talks, especially the first one in terms of the field and health co-benefits. So just to make sure everyone's on the same page, health co-benefits has been a growing field, and it's basically the concept that by mitigating climate change in a number of ways, you are also improving human health in a more short-term way. And a very robust field of research has been done specifically in the clean energy area and in the ways that by promoting clean energy, we're not only reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but also improving air pollution. And there are numerous short-term ill effects of air pollution, such as respiratory symptoms, pulmonary and cardiovascular disease, as well as premature death. In fact, last year, the WHO came out with a statement saying that they estimated 7 million deaths worldwide every year were due to air pollution, and about half of those due to ambient air pollution. And here in the U.S., although we have much more stringent regulations than in much of the world, there was still a recent study done by the EPA that found that in 2005, close to 70,000 premature deaths were directly attributable to fine particulate matter and ozone from power plants and mobile sources. So there are many health co-benefit studies out there, and in what we wanted to do that was a little bit different was instead of taking a policy analysis, a projection of the future given various policy scenarios or climate, to take work that had already been done partnering with the Department of Energy and the National Renewable Energy Lab that was looking at the technological feasibility of increasing renewable electricity generation in the United States, and taking that and partnering with them to find out what the health co-benefits would be if we reached those high levels of renewable energy. So just to give a little more background, the electric power sector is the largest sectoral component of the U.S. energy consumption, about 40% on its own. And right now that's mostly comprised of conventional sources, coal and natural gas, which almost all, you can see 90% of the coal that is used in the United States goes towards electricity consumption alone. And in addition to the negative greenhouse gas effects and the air pollution that comes from coal and natural gas, you also have the worker effects, all the life cycle effects that come from mining and extraction, and with natural gas, new concerns about fracking. So the Renewable Electricity Futures Study was really looking at, their main goal was to see if we could feasibly achieve 80% renewable electricity in 2050 using only currently available technology in the year 2010 when the study was started, and while balancing supply and demand at the hourly level, which is really important when considering renewable energy because of the intermittent nature of production. And they found that, yes, this was possible, it was feasible, and so our project was to take their output from the numerous scenarios they used to model this and find out what the health co-benefits would be associated with that possible future. So, in order to do this, we followed a sort of stepwise approach, similar to a lot of what's done in health co-benefit studies. This was a scoping analysis, so we used a number of reduced form factors that I will go through and created a rough estimate. So we started out with the output from the Renewable Electricity Futures Study. We used the year 2030. And looked at what the difference in generation from coal and natural gas would be in each scenario versus its respective baseline, and then converted that into the three criterion pollutants of interest, particulate matter, SOx, and NOx, for each scenario, and then finally converted that into health benefits. So starting a little bit more with the first step, the Renewable Electricity Futures Study, they modeled over 24 different scenarios in order to make sure that what they were coming up with was feasible. And they did exploratory scenarios from 30% to 90% renewable electricity penetration. And then they looked at a number of different issues related to electricity grid, such as constrained flexibility and constrained transmission that might affect whether or not this was possible. And the important thing to know is that most of these scenarios were based off of this low demand baseline. And in this baseline, they made the assumption that although population would grow and they expected some growth in electricity demand from increasing technologies, plug-in cars and other things, they also expected a concomitant increase in efficiency that would parallel this growth, resulting in essentially a low demand change between the year 2010 and 2050. However, they did also look at a high demand scenario and baseline as well to check that assumption. And on the right, you can see the different carbon dioxide reduction by our year of interest 2030 with some of these different scenarios. And as you would expect, they range depending on how much renewable electricity penetration there is. And you can see the second bar over from the right is with the high demand. So even if you reach 80% renewable electricity, if your demand is much, much higher than in the low demand scenario, you would still have much less carbon dioxide. So overall, we took each scenario, we took the coal and natural gas estimated in the projection for 2030, compared it to its baseline, and came out with a reduction in megawatt hours of that generation. And the next step was to convert that to the pollutants that I mentioned. And so in order to do that, we used emissions factors that were generated by our friends at EPA. And those were specific for the year 2030 for the three pollutants I mentioned. And they were to estimate per megawatt hour for the generation from coal and natural gas. And they were regional specific. You can see the map of the United States here. There's 9 regions that were used in the Markov model. And they used projections out to the future based on current regulations at the time this was done in 2012, and population and growth to estimate what the growth would be and created factors to the best of their knowledge to estimate these pollutants. So finally, getting to the area of interest for probably most people here, how do you take a decrease in pounds of pollution and turn that into health? Doing a health impact assessment can be a long and complicated modeling process with a lot of computing and technology and manpower beyond our capabilities. However, the EPA has also created a number of reduced form factors that are available for use that take a lot of the complex modeling and mapping and create simplified factors that are much easier to use and can create estimates. And so in order to understand these factors and the limitations, I'm just going to walk through how they were created. So the factors we used were specific for the electric power sector, and they created different factors for all the different energy sectors. And the first step was they used their concentration modeling to estimate the pollutions from the electricity power sector. And then they used BenMap, which was already mentioned in an earlier talk, and I just have a schema showing a little bit more about how that works. You can see you have the difference in the air quality, and then you take the air quality improvement, and BenMap has embedded concentration response, spatially specific population, and background population, health, and age, to help create the mortality reductions for specific area. And then to get the reduced form factor, they basically divided the output from the second part, BenMap, by the total pollution, and you get a linear response that you can then use to make your estimates. And just a few more notes about these factors. When they did this, they used a value of a statistical life in order to make the estimate of which is pretty commonly used, how much a human life is worth. And then they actually created four different factors for each sector, and that was because they chose to use both a 3% and a 7% discount rate, and they also used two different mortality risk estimates. One was based off of a 2009 study, Christie et al., that was based on the American Cancer cohort analysis, and the other was 2012, the Peel et al. Study that was based on the Harvard Six Cities study. And they felt that those two studies had different strengths and weaknesses, and so it was important to show essentially both of those concentration responses, as they may be either underestimates or overestimates, depending on the population of interest. And I just also wanted to point out that when you are creating, when EPA created these reduced form factors, for this particular set, they are national level factors, so we have lost the spatial specificity. They are now a national average, which I'll return to. So our results, this is a graph summarizing the results of a number of the, as many of the scenarios I could fit on the page. It's a little bit of a busy graph, so just to walk through it. On the left, you have the health benefits in the billions of dollars. So that is billions, and so the first line is 1,000 billion, which is a trillion. So these numbers are quite large. And then along the bottom, you have the different scenarios. And for each scenario, you see there are four different bars, and that's because of the four different benefit per ton estimates that were used. So they range from the smallest for 30% renewable energy would estimate a savings of about $100 billion in 2030. To a savings for the 90% renewable energy using the more conservative, the Kruski et al. Method, of still about $2 trillion, and other ones falling in between as would be expected. We also looked at the premature mortality numbers, because premature mortality is not as burdened with the assumptions that go into some of the modeling when you have to estimate what the value is of a human life, and you know how income will change and how you should discount that. So for the year 2030, for the 30% renewable electricity scenario, we found that approximately 9,000 premature deaths would be averted, whereas with the 90% renewable electricity scenario, using the the Lapula et al. Methodology, not Christie et al., as I had mistakenly put on the slide. So this was the highest number we found, was 540,000. And this is most likely an overestimate, considering what we know about the pure numbers of air pollution mortality today, although we would expect it to grow in the future. And I think that a lot of that comes from the numerous assumptions that go into doing a rough analysis of this sort. So going along through all the methodology, part of the reason I went into such detail is because there are so many assumptions that go in when you are tying together all these models. You have the assumptions that were inherent in the study we started out with, the assumptions they made about demand, how transmission flexibility is going to affect the grid. You have a lot of regulatory uncertainty, as always, predictions about technological improvement, and the linearity assumption, especially with the benefit per ton factors. You're assuming a linear relationship between pollution reduction and human health. However, that may not be a very realistic assumption. There is most likely a threshold effect, and that is skewing the results at the higher ends. And then something else we were concerned about was the spatial differences. So this is a map of the projected levels of particulate matter in 2016 from electricity generating units. And you can see that they are not evenly distributed across the US. Where we are is right now is kind of sitting under that red hot spot of higher density pollution in the Midwest. And so the factors that we were using were based off of this current level of pollution. So we hypothesized that if the reductions in pollution in from the coal and natural gas were consistent with the way this map was, then it would be okay to use these factors. But if it differed greatly, if there were larger reductions in other areas, then this would affect our results. So we looked at using those nine different regions, the nine different Markov regions, what percent of the national generation currently comes, this particular table is just for coal, comes from each of those areas versus what the projected decrease would be, to see if there were significant differences in how much certain areas were affected. And while some of them were quite similar, there were areas, especially in the south, where the projected decrease was larger than their current contribution. So in order to just get a very rough sense of how much this could be affecting our results, we used a different set of factors that were regional specific benefit per ton factors. Unfortunately, we couldn't use those for the whole study because they're not available for all regions, but we used the lowest available one for each pollutant to create the lowest possible number. And for the 80% renewable electricity penetration scenario, we still found that the total cost savings or total health benefits would be around $400 billion. So that is a big reduction from the $1.8 trillion that we had found for that same scenario using the initial factors. However, I would argue that $400 billion is still a very significant health savings. And we did a similar analysis using the 2016 factors instead of 2030 to try and look at how much of an impact the assumptions about income and population growth were having on the cost savings. And we found $1.4 trillion. So again, a reduction, but still a very large number. So overall, I think a lot of people think that high penetration renewable energy is not possible. There are many critics who think that we can't do it, that the grid isn't ready for it. And NREL's modeling has demonstrated that a lot of the capability is there, the technology is there. And our preliminary results are very rough, but they show that there would be significant health benefits, although potentially with issues to be thought of relating to occupational health as well. But there would be significant health benefits specifically from the air pollution reduction from coal and natural gas if we could have policies that helped us reach these possible technological changes. And so the public health community should really help raise awareness about these possible health benefits of increasing renewable energy. Thank you. Oh, and we had a lot of help with this. Worked very closely with the folks at NREL who did this study, Laura Vemmerstedt, Greg Brinkman, and Dan Steinberg. And the factors from EPA that I went into some explanation came from Dan Laughlin's group, Neil Fan, worked with Denise Mulholland, as well as Anna Belova from Apt Associates, which is the involved with BenMap. Thank you.
So we have time for a question or two, and I'm going to invite our panelists to come on up. So if there are particular questions about the remarks we just heard, let's have a question there, please.
As I said, I want to congratulate you on a good study. I'm sure John was proud as well. You mentioned that you think this might be an overestimate of the fact. And I was wondering, I was thinking perhaps it's not. If you use this renewable energy power as a source that previously was using hydrocarbons, let's say, like electric vehicles, or vehicles switched to electric, you might have a displacement effect on the back end. We're now powering in Georgia electric vehicles using compressed coal, right? The coal pump, our power plant right into a battery, and that's not a very good option because the emissions are not that good.
Right.
We displace that not only on the production side, but on the end use side, you might have an additive effect that we're displacing both the previous technologies. Did you, it didn't seem like it was included in here, but that could explain perhaps a greater effect.
That could, but I think, so our big concern was the number I mentioned in the beginning, the 70,000 estimate from 2005 was for both mobile and power plant sources. So it seemed to us like going from an estimate of 70,000 deaths in 2005 from both of those sources to so much larger made it seem like there was a bit of an overestimate skewing going on. But I would have to think a bit more about it, but